Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Imagine for a moment that you are the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
You have spent decades walking the dusty plains of India, turning the wheel of the Dharma, gathering thousands of followers, and, well, establishing a path to ultimate liberation.
Right.
But now, your physical body is failing. You are about to pass away, entering final nirvana. And you know with absolute certainty that the world you leave behind will eventually descend into a dark age of suffering, distraction, and spiritual destitution.
A terrifying prospect for a teacher.
Exactly. So who do you leave in charge of your teachings? You don't just leave the humans. You summon the absolute highest gods of your rival religious traditions.
The absolute peak of the cosmos.
Right. Beings who possess unimaginable cosmic power. And you bind them to a vow to protect your students. Welcome to this deep dive. Today we are undertaking a very special journey, a shared contemplation between practitioners. We are exploring a profoundly sacred text from the Tibetan Buddhist canon. It's called the Noble Durin of the Buddha's Essence. And we ask you, the listener, to join us not merely as a passive audience member, but as a fellow traveler on the path.
I am so deeply glad we are doing this. It is a profound joy to share this contemplative space with you.
Thank you. It really is.
The scenario you just described, the Buddha passing the torch to the highest gods of the cosmos, that is the actual literal staging of the sutra we are looking at today. But before we immerse ourselves in the philosophy, we really must pause.
Yeah, we have to acknowledge where this comes from.
We do. We must express our deepest reverence and gratitude for the source of the translation we are using today. This text comes to us through the monumental efforts of the 84,000 Project.
I am so glad you brought them up right at the start. Because what the 84,000 Project is doing, it almost defies comprehension in its sheer scale.
It really does.
For those listening who might be encountering this name for the very first time today, what exactly is their mission?
Their mission is breathtakingly vast. The 84,000 Project is a global nonprofit initiative, and they are dedicated to translating the entirety of the Buddha's words into modern languages.
The entirety. That is just staggering.
Right. Specifically, they are translating the vast Tibetan Kingyu and Tenyur, and they are making them freely available to everyone everywhere.
Let's make sure we ground those terms for you listening. When we say the Kingyur, what are we actually talking about?
Excellent point. So for context, the Kingyur is essentially the Tibetan equivalent of the Buddha's direct spoken words.
Okay.
It is a massive, staggering library of over 100 volumes of sutras and tantras. And the Tenyur is the accompanying collection of commentaries by the great Indian masters.
Right, the commentaries that unpack all those dense sutras.
Exactly. And for centuries, these texts were essentially locked behind the incredibly high barrier of classical Tibetan and Sanskrit. You had to be a specialized scholar just to read them.
Or a monk dedicating decades of your life to the language.
Right. But the 84,000 Project is meticulously, rigorously translating all of it. And the text we are exploring today, it's provided under a Creative Commons license.
That is amazing.
It is an open gift to the world, free from commercial barriers. In a world that so often commodifies wisdom, you know, turning mindfulness into an app subscription, the 84,000 Project acts as a pure conduit.
Yeah.
They ensure that the water of the lineage flows freely to anyone thirsty enough to drink.
It's a modern marvel of Dharma preservation, truly.
Yeah.
And, you know, we know the preservation is never easy. We know from the historical record that past generations went to agonizing length to preserve this specific teaching.
Absolutely.
But that raises a massive question for me. Why this one? What makes this relatively short text so dangerously important that past generations literally counted its syllables to ensure its survival?
That is the right question to ask.
To understand that, we have to look back at how it reached us.
Mm-hmm.
Where does the Durin of the Buddha's essence actually come from?
Well, to understand the gravity of this text, we have to travel back to the 8th and 9th centuries, to the high Himalayas.
The golden era.
Exactly. This was a golden era of translation in Tibet. And the translator's colophon of our text, which is the little historical note at the end, it tells us exactly who worked on it.
That's a pretty heavy-hitting team, right?
Very much so. It was translated by two great Indian preceptors, Jinamitra and Dhanashila, and they were working shoulder to shoulder with the legendary Tibetan translator, the great Lhotsawa Yeshe Day.
I try to imagine what that room looked like, you know? You have these brilliant Indian panditas who hold the entire Sanskrit tradition in their minds.
Yes.
And this Tibetan genius who is literally helping to invent a standardized philosophical language for Tibet, just so these concepts can even be expressed.
Right, because the vocabulary didn't even exist in Tibetan yet.
The physical and intellectual effort must have been staggering.
Staggering is the right word. Because they weren't just casually translating a novel, you know. They believed they were carrying the exact technology for human liberation across a linguistic border.
Wow. The technology for human liberation.
Yes. And their dedication was absolute. We know this because this text leaves a very distinct, heavily audited historical footprint. It appears in the Imperial Tibetan Fangthangma Inventory.
Okay.
It also appears in the Denkarma Inventory.
Now, I have read that the Denkarma was an incredibly meticulous catalog of translated works. But the methodology they used to track these texts, that is what really blows my mind.
Yes. The Denkarma didn't just list titles like a modern library catalog. That would be too risky.
Right.
It tracked the exact length of texts by measuring them in shlokas or sansas. It lists our text as being exactly 38 shlokas long.
Only 38.
Yes. Bummer. And it carefully distinguishes it from a slightly longer sibling text of 55 shlokas.
Wait, I need to stop you there because I want to make sure I am fully grasping the stakes here. Why would imperial catalogers go to that agonizing level of detail?
It's a great question.
Why count the stanzas, the syllables, of a text?
Because the stakes were nothing less than reality itself. That level of administrative precision, it wasn't just bureaucracy. It was an act of fierce, desperate devotion.
Devotion.
Yeah.
Think about it this way. If you are transmitting a medical formula that cures a fatal disease, you do not approximate the ingredients.
No, you measure every milligram.
Exactly. You measure every single milligram. The translators and catalogers viewed the Dharma in the exact same way.
Huh.
By counting the syllables, they were ensuring that not a single drop of the meaning, not a single nuance of the energetic resonance was lost or altered by lazy scribes or future generations. They were building a linguistic arc for the teachings.
A linguistic arc. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
It's essentially quality control for ultimate truth.
Precisely.
And this text didn't just survive in that one Tibetan inventory either.
Far from it. We find it safely preserved in the predominantly Shalpa Kangyurs. We also see its footprint expanding massively across Asia.
Right, it moved into China.
Yes, it was translated into Chinese by the legendary monk Xuanzang in the year 650 CE.
Xuanzang, just an incredibly famous historical figure.
Right.
This is a man who walked across blazing deserts and freezing mountains for years just to bring authentic texts from India back to China.
A literal hero of the lineage. And then it was translated again into Chinese in the late 10th century by another great master, Fashion.
So we have this web of brilliant devoted minds, Jinamitra, Dhanashila, Yurisei, Duanzang, Fashion, all dedicating their lives crossing deserts and mountain ranges to preserving this specific teaching.
And that is precisely why this history matters to you listening to us right now.
Yes.
I want you to really feel this. When we study this text today, we are not looking at an isolated museum artifact. We are participating in an unbroken lineage of preservation that spans empires, languages, and millennia.
That is profound.
The breath that carried the chant in the 8th century in a stone room in Tibet, it is the exact same stream of awakened intent that we are drawing upon today.
That perfectly frames our mission for this deep dive. Our goal today is to systematically walk through this living text.
Yes.
We want to understand its vast cosmology, unpack its core philosophical teachings, and ultimately uncover how this ancient dialogue serves as a direct, intimate instruction for your own meditation practice tomorrow morning.
A beautiful mission.
So, having established the history, let us look at the text itself. The scene that opens this sutra is so vivid.
Please set the stage for us. Let us visualize the environment where this teaching actually occurs.
All right, so the text opens with a classic grounding statement of bearing witness. Thus did I hear at one time.
The traditional opening.
The Blessed One is seated upon a lion throne, which is a profound symbol of the absolute fearlessness and unassailable authority of his realization.
Right.
He is in a seashore grove. And the text specifically notes that he is completely surrounded by a forest that represents the Buddha's domain.
Let's pause on that imagery for a second, because the environment in a sutra is never accidental.
It's always symbolic, isn't it?
It is itself a teaching. You have the vast, infinite ocean on one side. And in Buddhist literature, the ocean so often represents the unfathomable depths of reality, the endless expanse of the awakened mind. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, you have the dense, enclosed grove, which represents a sacred, protected container. A focused, grounded space for the teaching to manifest.
It's a beautiful staging. It feels both infinite and intensely intimate at the exact same time.
It does.
But what makes the setting truly extraordinary is the audience. The Buddha is not speaking to human monks or kings or lay people in this moment.
No, he is not.
He's teaching a retinue of gods. Specifically, he addresses the gods of the Suddhavasa realm, and he calls out figures like Maheshvara and Suvrata.
And this is where we really must map the cosmology carefully, because understanding who the Buddha is talking to is the key to understanding the entire text. For our fellow practitioners navigating the intricacies of Buddhist cosmology, existence is generally categorized into three realms.
Okay, let's break them down.
There is the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. We humans currently reside in the desire realm because we are driven by our sensory cravings.
Right. Our world is defined by wanting things, avoiding things, and physical limitations.
Exactly.
But where is Suddhavasa? What realm is that?
Suddhavasa, which translates to the pure abodes or Naskesang Mairi in Tibetan, is the absolute zenith of the form realm.
The absolute peak.
Yes. It is the highest heavenly realm of physical existence. But here's the crucial point. It is not a place you can be born into simply through good karma.
Okay.
Or by giving to charity or basic worldly virtue.
So you can't just buy your way in with good deeds.
Exactly. You cannot. It is a realm accessible exclusively to those who have attained the fourth and highest level of meditative absorption.
Wow.
In Sanskrit, this is called Daya, and in Tibetan, Bisam Jiton.
Let's break down what that actually means, because meditative absorption can sound like a very dry clinical term to modern ears.
It can.
But we are talking about beings who possess an unimaginable degree of mental refinement here.
We are talking about beings who have completely mastered their own minds. To reach the fourth dhyana, a being has stripped away all attachment to pleasure, all aversion to pain, all mental wandering.
Just total stillness.
They exist in a state of continuous, unbroken, luminous equanimity. Their concentration is so profound, so stable, that it literally generates a higher dimension of reality to house them.
So these gods are not just powerful figures throwing lightning bolts around. They are the supreme masters of meditation.
Supreme masters.
They reside at the very ceiling of reality as we can conceive it, right before existence dissolves entirely into the formless realms.
That is the perfect way to phrase it.
And what's fascinating here is who the sutra specifically names among these gods. It names Maheshvara and Suvrata.
Yes. And in the socio-religious landscape of ancient India, naming those two specific figures is a profound, almost staggering statement.
Why is that?
Because Maheshvara is the highest godhead in the Saiva tradition. He is Shiva himself, the creator, the destroyer, the ultimate reality for millions of practitioners.
Wow.
And Suvrata, or Muna Suvrata, is recognized as the 20th Arhat, or Tuttokara, of the current cosmic cycle in the Jain tradition.
Wait, I really need to push back on this, or at least play devil's advocate for a moment.
Please do.
Because the sutra is taking the absolute highest deities, the supreme spiritual peaks of parallel, competing Indian religions, and placing them in the audience as devoted students of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to modern ears, isn't that just a convenient piece of ancient propaganda? Isn't it just a way to make Buddhism look superior by saying, look, your gods worship our guy?
That is exactly how a cynical, historical, critical lens might view it.
Right.
But if we look at this as practitioners, there is a much deeper philosophical mechanism at work here.
Could you unpack that for us?
By placing Maheshvara and Suvrata in the Suddhavasa realm, the Buddhist text is actually acknowledging their immense spiritual stature. It concedes that the Shiva and Jain paths are incredibly profound. It admits that their practices lead to the very summit of cyclic existence. To the absolute peak of Samsara.
Okay, so it's not insulting them, it's actually elevating them to the highest possible worldly status.
Precisely. However, the core teaching here is that no matter how refined, no matter how elevated, pure, or peaceful that state is, the zenith of Samsara is still Samsara.
Because they're still caught in the cycle.
Yes. they are still ultimately worldly beings. They experience states of unimaginable bliss and concentration that last for eons.
But
they have not fully crossed over into the unconditioned reality of full awakening. Mm-hmm. They still have a subtle trace of ego, a subtle conceptual framework.
Right.
Therefore, to make that final leap into ultimate liberation, even the highest gods must rely on the Buddha's teaching.
That completely shifts the perspective. Makes me think of an analogy. Is it similar to, say, a master architect calling in the highest-ranking engineers from the world's most advanced competing firms?
Ooh, I like this.
The architect isn't bringing them together to humiliate them. He is bringing them together because he has a blueprint for a structure that transcends all of their individual earthbound projects.
Yes.
He needs their brilliance, their capacity, to help build something universal.
That is a very helpful analogy. It is a universalizing of the Dharma. The text humbles the cosmos.
It humbles the cosmos.
Wow.
If the highest, most powerful gods of the universe, beings of pure light and unbroken concentration, must sit at the feet of the Buddha to learn the final truth, it reminds us, as ordinary human practitioners, of the unsurpassable value of the path of awakening.
Yeah.
It tells us that true liberation goes beyond even the highest meditative bliss.
It really reorients your sense of scale. And having established this magnificent cosmic setting, you know, the Buddha on a lion thrown by the ocean, addressing the most powerful, refined beings in the universe, we must now look at the inciting incident.
Yes.
Why has he summoned them? What is the core problem driving this text?
The occasion is deeply poignant and, frankly, quite heavy. The text shifts from this grand, luminous cosmology to a stark, unavoidable reality.
What reality?
The Buddha's impending departure. The Buddha is preparing for his parinirvet.
Let's define parinirvet clearly for you listening, because it is a concept laden with both profound sorrow and profound realization.
Parinirvet is the final passing away of a fully awakened Buddha.
Okay.
While a Buddha achieves nirvana, or awakening, during their lifetime, meaning they extinguish the flames of greed, hatred, and delusion, parinirvet marks the point where their physical karma is exhausted.
Right.
They leave their physical body, and they will no longer manifest a physical form within the cyclic bounds of birth and death.
It is an intensely dramatic moment of transition. For the spiritual community, the Sangha, it is terrifying.
Absolutely terrifying.
They must learn to navigate the dark, confusing forest of the world without the physical presence, the voice, the direct guidance of their teacher.
Exactly. And you will notice the text continually refers to the Buddha here as the Tathagata.
The Tathagata. Thus gone one, or thus come one. It's such a mysterious, evocative title.
It is. It emphasizes that the Buddha is not just a historical person named Siddhartha Gautama who lived and died. A Tathagata is a manifestation of ultimate reality.
Oh, I see.
He is someone who has fully realized the nature of things just as they are, and who comes and goes in accordance with that truth. And the Tathagata knows that his physical form is leaving.
So he looks at this gathering of supreme gods, and he gives them a sacred, incredibly heavy charge.
A massive responsibility.
He tells them they must look after the fourfold retinue in the future.
We should really specify who the fourfold retinue is, because it directly includes the people listening to us right now.
It does. The fourfold retinue is the complete community of practitioners, fully ordained monks, fully ordained nuns, male lay practitioners, and female lay practitioners.
Yes.
It is vital to note that lay people, people with jobs, families, and everyday struggles, are explicitly included in the Buddha's protective vision.
They are the very center of his concern.
I want to read the Buddha's direct quote here, and I'm going to read it slowly because this is the emotional core of the text.
Please do.
He says to the highest gods of the universe, "As long as there are beings who are destitute and affected by the obscurations, you should preserve the teaching of the thus gone one for them. Teach it and promote it."
If we step back and look at the philosophical framework, this command embodies the absolute beating heart of the great vehicle, the Mahayana tradition.
How so?
Because the Mahayana path is not just about a single individual escaping from suffering and finding their own private peace.
Right. It's much bigger than that.
It is defined by a relentless, sweeping, agonizingly compassionate commitment to caring for all beings across unimaginably vast stretches of time.
Yeah.
The Buddha is looking down the corridor of history. He sees the dark, destitute periods between the appearances of fully enlightened Buddha.
The eras where teachings fade.
Exactly. Where people are overwhelmed by their obscurations, by their greed and anger. And he is ensuring that no one is left behind. He is literally conscripting the highest powers of the cosmos to serve the most vulnerable, struggling human beings.
It is the ultimate act of care. He is essentially saying, my physical body is leaving this realm, but my compassion is not leaving. I am installing you, the gods of the highest realms, as the permanent stewards of my compassion.
What a beautiful way to phrase it.
But he is a supreme teacher, so he doesn't just give them an inspiring speech and walk away. He gives them a specific tool, a technology to accomplish this impossible task.
Yeah.
He gives them the Dharan of the Buddha's essence.
The sutra transitions from the narrative of his departure and the sorrow of his leaving to the actual transmission of the method. Now, I would like to carefully and reverently recite a portion of the mantra as it appears in the text. I want to do this so that we, and you listening, can actually hear the syllables that echo back to that seashore grove.
Please.
The Buddha says this is the Dharma discourse. Tyata teshe tiratva dejasu tiko pari praptarte shanta prashanta pasanta samashanta vimokano prapte supati puto harmatatu atyanta sunisrite.
Beautiful.
It continues from there, a beautiful stream of resonant Sanskrit terms that describe profound peace, ultimate liberation, and the unshakable realm of truth.
Just hearing those syllables spoken aloud brings the ancient text rushing into the present moment. It bridges the gap between the 8th century and today.
It really does.
Now, we often encounter the word Dharan in modern Buddhist practice.
And here is where I think we really need to dig deep. Because I know there is a massive misconception about this.
Very much so.
In casual modern understanding, we often think of a Dharan simply as a magic spell. We think of it as a long string of syllables you chant to ward off bad luck or to get a new job or to cure a headache. But reading this text and looking at the stakes involved, it reveals a much more profound cognitive mechanism at work.
Absolutely. To strip away the magic spell misconception, we must look at the Tibetan translation of the term Dharan, the one used by Yesha Day and the Indian masters.
What word did they use?
They translated it as zums. Specifically, the text uses the phrase, those paryipu chams kad ki zungs.
And what does zungs literally mean?
Translators often render gzungs as the power of retaining or to hold.
To hold.
It is not merely a set of magical verses. In the deep context of the Great Vehicle, a Dharan is a highly advanced spiritual capacity. It's a state of mind attained by high-level bodhisattvas.
Okay, so it's a cognitive state.
It is the cognitive meditative power to retain the entire ocean of knowledge without ever forgetting it.
That completely reframes the entire concept. It isn't a spell you cast outwards into the world to change the weather. It is an architectural capacity you build inwards, in your own mind. But I have to ask, and this is a question I invite you, the listener, to ponder deeply with us.
It's an important question.
How does that actually work? Does reciting a string of syllables mechanically, like a parrot, magically grant you this superpower of memory?
That is the essential inquiry of a true practitioner. And the answer is no. Mechanical recitation alone does not grant realization.
Right. Just saying the words isn't enough.
The recitation of the syllables is the outer shell of the practice. But consider how memory and mind work. The true function of the Dharan is transformative. It works somewhat like an incredibly profound mnemonic framework, but on a spiritual and energetic level.
Okay, a mnemonic framework.
By repeating these specific phonetic structures, which are encoded with the meaning of peace, liberation, and emptiness during states of deep concentration, you are essentially creating new neurological or energetic grooves in the mind.
So the intense meditative discipline, the devotion, the sheer concentration required to uphold and internalize the text. That effort actually reshapes the mind.
Exactly. Reshapes the mind. When the text speaks of the mind holding the ocean of knowledge, it means a mind that has transcended ordinary, fragmented, distracted conceptual thought.
Right.
Our normal minds are like leaky buckets. We hear a profound truth, and 5 minutes later, we are angry at the traffic, and the truth has leaked out.
I know that feeling all too well.
A mind that is settled into the shanta prashanta, the peace and profound peace explicitly mentioned in the mantra, is a mind whose bucket has been sealed.
Sealed tight.
It naturally reflects reality without distortion. The syllables of the Dharan act as an anchor, an energetic frequency that continuously tunes the practitioner's mind back to the reality of the Tathagata.
So by giving this Dharan to the gods and through them to us, the Buddha is literally handing over the blueprint for generating a mind equal to his own.
Yes.
He is saying, use these syllables to build the container that can hold my wisdom after I am gone. which brings us beautifully to the next section of the sutra, the specific fruits of the path.
The promised results.
Exactly. The Buddha outlines the precise benefits for practitioners who genuinely engage with this teren.
And he is very clear about the progression of these benefits. He specifically promises them to the fourfold community, again, including us lay people, who wear it on their bodies, recite it well, and uphold it.
Let's walk through that progression, because it's fascinating how it moves from the psychological to the visionary and finally to the absolute.
It is a profound sequence.
It begins with psychological protection. The Buddha states that the practitioner will never give rise to inferior mental states. Now, in the context of advanced practice, what does he mean by inferior mental states? He doesn't just mean feeling a bit sad, right?
No. Inferior mental states refers directly to the afflictions, the kleshas.
The kleshas.
It means anger, blinding greed, paralyzing jealousy, deep delusion, despair. These are the very mechanisms that keep the wheel of samsara turning. The dhoran acts as a seal protecting the mind. Because the mind is anchored in the frequency of the Buddha's essence, it simply does not have the space or the resonance to allow those toxic reactive states to take root.
It provides a baseline of emotional and spiritual absolute zero, a pure foundation.
Precisely.
And from there, the benefits move into visionary meditative experiences. The text says the practitioner will feel the thus gone one seated directly above the crown of your head.
This is a classic, profound visualization practice that is still the bedrock of Vajrayana Buddhism today.
Right.
Feeling the physical, energetic presence of the Buddha at the crown of the head is not just a comforting thought. It is an active lineage connection.
An active connection.
It signifies the continuous, unbroken blessing of the awakened teacher pouring down into the central channel of the student.
The text goes even further, saying that some will certainly see the Buddha, some will hear him teach.
Yep.
This speaks to a level of meditative realization where the barrier between historical time and the eternal present dissolves. You aren't remembering a teacher from 2,500 years ago. Your mind is pure enough to access the living Dharma directly in the present moment.
And as a result of that direct access, the text says, some will become Dharma teachers and some will gain the dharan power of not forgetting.
So they become the vessel themselves.
Here we see the living fruition of the Buddha's vow. The student who is suffering becomes the teacher who relieves suffering, ensuring that the continual stream of Dharma teachers that the Buddha promised to the gods actually manifests in the world.
But the text doesn't stop at these immense, yet still somewhat relative, benefits. Because becoming a great teacher or having visions is amazing, but it isn't the final goal of Buddhism.
No, it is not. And this raises the most important question regarding the ultimate horizon of Buddhist practice.
What is that horizon?
This text, like all profound Mahayana sutras, is not just offering temporary worldly comfort. It is not just a psychological salve to make your daily life a bit less stressful.
Right.
It promises an uninterrupted trajectory where the student will understand everything, never forget it, and be only one birth away from awakening. It drives relentlessly toward the absolute climax of realization.
The text names this ultimate milestone specifically. It states that the practitioner will receive all the attainments culminating in, and this is a phrase we must hold with immense reverence and focus, acceptance of the fact that phenomena do not arise.
Yes.
In Tibetan, that is Miskai by Chos Labsodpa Topa.
Let us take a deep breath here and take the time to truly unpack this concept, for it is the absolute philosophical capstone of the great vehicle.
Okay.
Acceptance of the fact that phenomena do not arise, which is often referred to in Sanskrit as anutpatika dharma kanti, is the direct non-conceptual realization of emptiness, or shunyata.
Okay, emptiness is a term that gets thrown around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
What does it actually mean to say that phenomena do not arise?
It's notoriously difficult to grasp.
Because, I mean, I am looking at a table right now. It arose. It was built. It is here. It seems very real to me.
To say that phenomena do not arise means that when we look at the ultimate, microscopic, fundamental nature of reality, no single thing, no object, no thought, no emotion, no sense of a permanent self possesses inherent, independent, or permanent existence.
Because everything exists in a state of dependent origination. Nothing stands alone.
Exactly.
The table is made of wood, which requires rain, soil, sunlight, the lumberjack, the carpenter. Therefore, because it is entirely dependent on an infinite web of other causes, the table itself cannot truly be said to have a discrete beginning or an independent arising.
Precisely. If a phenomenon lacks its own inherent isolated existence, it cannot truly arise from nowhere, nor can it truly cease into nothingness.
Just a temporary convergence of causes.
It is an appearance. It is like a dream, an illusion, an echo. It appears vividly to our senses, but it lacks a solid, unchanging core.
I want to introduce a metaphor here to see if it helps clarify this or for you listening.
Mm-hmm.
Is realizing that phenomena don't arise.
Mm-hmm.
Is it somewhat like realizing you're watching a movie in a theater?
Oh, let's explore that.
Let's say there is a terrifying explosion on the screen. To the immersed mind, the explosion is real, it's loud, it's deadly.
You tense up in your seat.
Right. But when you realize it is just light projected onto a blank wall, you don't run screaming out of the theater. The image is still there. You still see the explosion. But the danger, the inherent reality of the explosion, never actually arose.
That is a brilliant metaphor. The explosion appears, but it never truly arose. The problem is, for the ordinary ego-driven human mind, we believe the movie is real.
We think we're in the explosion.
We are terrified of the explosion. Therefore, the realization that things do not inherently exist, that our own ego is just light on a screen, is deeply terrifying at first.
It shakes you to your core.
It shatters the very foundation of our grasping. It strips away all of our worldly security.
And I think that explains a very specific word used in the text. Why does the sutra use the word acceptance or tolerance? The Tibetan word is zordpa. The Sanskrit is Kanti. Why tolerance of non-arising?
Because gazing into the truth of emptiness requires immense spiritual resilience. It requires profound tolerance.
Tolerance of what?
When you look into the vast, open, ungrounded nature of reality, the ego panics. The mind wants something solid to hold on to. To look at the illusion of your own self, to see it dissolve and to endure that loss without flinching.
Without looking away.
Without falling into despair or nihilism. That takes ultimate tolerance. You must accept the liberating, terrifying truth of non-arising.
That is beautifully explained. We need the tolerance, the spiritual courage, to endure the loss of our illusions.
Yeah.
And the Buddha is saying that engaging deeply with this dharan, using those syllables to cultivate that ocean-like container of a stabilized mind, is exactly what gives us the capacity, the resilience, to finally sit in the theater. To look at the terrifying movie of reality and accept that it does not arise and does not cease.
Exactly.
That realization is true freedom from the cycle of birth and death. That is how one becomes, as the text promises, a fully liberated, perfect Buddha who is free from obscurations.
It is a stunning ultimate promise. The text takes us from the physical seashore grove all the way to the absolute pinnacle of awakened consciousness.
It's an incredible journey.
And having revealed this ultimate horizon, the sutra then gracefully, beautifully returns us to the narrative resolution.
Back to the gods.
The Buddha finishes his profound instruction and looks back to his audience, to the gods of Suddhavasa.
He looks at Maivar and Sudrata. He tells them they will understand the meaning of these teachings in this very lifetime, and he issues his final echoing command. Do not cast it aside, do not forsake it, and do not forget it.
A direct order.
And the gods, representing the absolute highest peak of worldly existence, the masters of the cosmos, reply without a single moment of hesitation. They vow, Blessed One, we will do just that. We will teach it and promote it among noble sons and daughters.
It is a moment of profound cosmic surrender and devotion. The gods vow to protect and transmit the teachings. They bow their immense power to the supreme wisdom of non-arising.
I am so deeply struck by the beautiful chain of transmission here. Think about the links in this chain.
It's breathtaking when you map it out.
We have the Buddha, who realizes the ultimate truth and prepares to leave his body. He teaches the gods. The gods, in their devotion, vow to protect the text and transmit it to human beings.
Yes.
Human beings, those brilliant translators like Jinamitra, Dhanashela, and Yeshe, they dedicate their lives, braving the Himalayas to translate it into Tibetan.
Scribes painstakingly copy it by hand.
Kings measure it by the syllable. Centuries later, the 84,000 Project translates it into modern English. And now, today, in this very moment, we are speaking these words, and you are listening.
If we truly recognize the reality of this lineage, we must speak directly to you, the practitioner listening to this deep dive right now. The very fact that we are exploring this text today, translated from the ancient Tibetan canon, means that the vow made by Mahivara and Suvrata in that seashore grove thousands of years ago is still active.
It is functioning right now.
Your engagement with this text, your willingness to sit, to focus your mind, and to deeply listen is the living, breathing fruition of that ancient gathering. The continuum is unbroken. You are the noble son or daughter the gods vowed to reach.
Let us take a deep, mindful breath here to absorb the weight of that responsibility and the profound nature of that blessing. As we draw this deep dive toward a close, let's gather up the threads of what we've explored today in a measured summary.
A good idea.
We entered a sacred text that serves as a bridge across the sorrow of the Buddha's physical absence. We witnessed the highest worldly gods, the zenith of the Saiva and Jain traditions, being enlisted not as rivals to be mocked, but as devoted protectors of the universal Mahayana community.
We critically redefined the concept of Dharan. We moved far past the superficial idea of a magic spell to understand it as an advanced cognitive architecture.
Right.
A cultivated, mnemonic, and energetic power to retain an ocean of wisdom without it ever leaking away. And we saw how the discipline of this practice culminates in the ultimate philosophical insight.
The profound resilience, the spiritual tolerance, to accept that phenomena do not truly arise.
Precisely.
And so we must return to the practical application, because philosophy without practice is just intellectual entertainment. How do we walk away from this deep dive and carry it into the grit and friction of our daily lives?
We must remind ourselves that to study this text, to recite this Tarin, is not an act of mere historical repetition. It is the active, deliberate cultivation of a vast, unforgetting container for wisdom.
Yeah.
When you sit on your meditation cushion, when you read the Dharma, you are participating in the preservation of the Buddha's essence. You are training your own mind to hold the ocean.
So what does this all mean for you tomorrow morning? Because this is where the rubber meets the road.
It is.
If the ultimate realization promised by this Tarin is the acceptance of the fact that phenomena do not arise, how does that alter your everyday mundane experience? Tomorrow, when you face a world that seems to be constantly aggressively arising.
When your inbox is flooding with urgent demands.
When a conflict flares up with a loved one. When the news cycle is terrifying. When the world feels unbelievably heavy and falling apart right in front of your eyes. What happens if you view that stress through the lens of this text?
What happens when you pause amidst that chaos? Take a single breath and remember that beneath the turbulent, terrifying movie of those arising events, there is the profound peace, the Hyanta Prashanta, of emptiness.
What happens when you realize the explosion on the screen cannot burn you?
Could upholding this essence, this Tarin, change not just your memory of a sacred text, but your very perception of reality itself?
Could it give you the tolerance, the kananti, to remain unbroken by the illusions of the world, knowing that none of your anxieties truly arise and none of them truly cease? We leave you with that final contemplation to explore in your own practice.
Thank you so much for exploring this with us.
We deeply honor your time, your focus, and your dedication to the Dharma. May this deep dive be a cause for the awakening of all beings. Thank you for joining us.
Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts from bodyarchive.org.